Connie Collinsworth. How are you, friend?
I'm good. I had a good holiday weekend, and now I'm back to busier than I have been. So
I feel you on that one. I took an extended Thanksgiving break because we had best parents come out. They hadn't visited us since 2018. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time we ever had family out for Thanksgiving. So it was nice. But I tell you, forced time away from work puts me in this mental spot where the entire week, I'm not working per se. Like, I didn't make any new projects. I didn't write back to any emails. Like, so I physically, did I work? Absolutely no. But the entire time, am I moving mental chess pieces around? Abso-fucking-lutely. Like, I am literally just saying, okay, so if I did this on Mondays, slid that over to Tuesdays, what's that Wednesday look like? Like, just literally playing mental chess the entire time.
Yeah, last week I had all my stuff planned out. Coulter's got a couple of tour dates, the first ones since 2019.
Wow.
Very early 2020, like beginning of January. A couple of them this coming Friday and Saturday, leading up to his Ryman headlining debut on the 10th. And so, like, there aren't much shows going on, but I've got to organize all that merch and the logistics of getting it to the people who have to get it there in time for when they're traveling for the shows. And so last week I was like, oh, I got this all planned out. I've got plenty of time. This is going to get done here. And then the holiday slammed in and it's like everything went whoop, like fast forward straight up to like today. And I'm like, okay, I have till tomorrow now. What the hell happened? Because other people take off the holidays, Mark. And
what a concept.
And so I was like, you know, I struggle with that a lot. Like, I'll answer a text or do business at 1 a.m. or on a weekend or on a holiday if it furthers me to get my shit done. And other people are just like, and not all, but other people that I sometimes rely on are like, oh, I just checked out. And I'm like, okay, well, these deadlines are still there.
Yeah.
Regardless of if one component checks out or not. So I enjoyed my time. I was a little stressed. My television watching helped greatly during this week.
And it was a good time because there was a decent drop of new content that was flowing. And the big thing we're going to talk about is this Beatles documentary that Peter Jackson went through 60 hours of footage, 150 hours of recordings. And before we even get into what we learned about the Beatles, which I felt like I kind of knew a lot about, now feel even more bizarrely attached to them. And I think, without getting too ahead of myself, I feel like this experience humanized the Beatles in a way that I'd never seen them humanized. For once, they looked like four of my friends in a band versus four rock gods that were completely in this untouchable space. But before we get to all that, Connie, before there was any editing, imagine the work that Peter Jackson and his team went through to take that old film, shot on film, digitizing it, color correcting it, and then getting that audio to sound so clean. Like, you never heard any microphone noises. You never heard any wind. You never heard any pops in the mics. The footage always looked crystal clear, pristine. It never looked grainy. The coloring was always consistent. It wasn't a natural color palette that they used, but it was a consistent color palette that they used. So as far as going back to 1969, when this band is doing something nobody had ever heard of before, like, people didn't make documentaries about them making records. People didn't just say, we're going to take 3 weeks, write songs in front of people, make a TV show, play our first concert in 3 years. And oh, by the way, we have zero songs. We showed up with nothing.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily know if anyone but Paul fully understood going into it, the number of people and the amount that would be recorded and what the what would be allowed to be recorded.
Yeah.
You know, George makes that one the comment in there like, oh, you're recording our conversations too. You know, it's like, yeah, it's on all the time. And thank goodness it was, you know, I was just amazed. I was, you know, you and I were both looking forward to this. We've talked about it on several occasions leading up to it coming out. And, you know, knowing that originally it was going to be a 2.5 hour movie would have been a wash now.
It would have been pointless.
Yeah. So, Peter Jackson and his team going in and looking at it, and I think their original cut was 18 hours or something.
I'll watch it.
And that's when they had to show it to Paul and Ringo and whoever else, Sean Lennon, I think, watched it, some other people. And because they were like, not sure that they wanted it made. Yeah. And so I think they went to them and they said, well, let us see it. And they showed them that. And they were like, oh, okay, we'll see kind of what you're doing here. And then they had, but they can't put out 18 hours because they said 2.5. So then they further edit it down. And for me, editing in anything that you do creatively is the worst part.
Well, if you think about it, so let's start here. If you have 60 hours of footage, okay, and you load up 1 hour of footage and you watch 1 minute of 1 hour, you watch that hour as somebody who edits video, you watch that hour or that first minute and you go, okay, Paul's having a conversation with John. So somewhere in your creative process, you have to take that minute, you turn that minute into a clip, you either color code it or you give it some sort of number in a log, like whatever your system is. I use the color coding system in Premiere, but I'm sure with a project like this, they have everything like logged out. So you watch that minute, you have to categorize what's the emotion, what are they talking about, where does this one Lego fit into the entire thing that I'm trying to build. And literally the time that you can spend just combing through that 1 minute, maybe taking out something that, you know, oh, they said something that's off colored because this is going back 60 years and they probably don't want to, you know, even though it's a cigarette, they probably don't want to be using the F word for cigarettes because that's confusing to young listeners and then they'll get canceled. Even they're like, do you have a smoke? So like literally 1 minute can turn into 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 2 minutes. But that conversion of 1 minute to unknown X times 60 in an hour times 60 hours just means an unlimited amount of time was spent just categorizing everything. And one thing that the team had going for them is at least it was a linear story. You know, they knew where they were starting and they knew where they were stopping. So it was probably getting it down to, is this essential? Is this essential to the story we're trying to tell?
It reminds me of like a Tarantino project where yeah. when you're watching Pulp Fiction and we see all these cuts and all these things and we're like, why are we seeing this as a viewer? And then when the end comes, we know why we saw all of right. that stuff. Same as like with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think isn't there like an 8 hour version of that movie that he actually cut together? So then he had to go and make a palatable to the public version. But then the ones of us who are obsessed will sit there and watch that 8 hour version, you know. But Tarantino knew all of that stuff. And I think that Peter Jackson, his team had to watch it all. Mm-hmm. And then they knew what was important and what to put out there, what to leave in, what to take out. Now, whether that everyone agrees on how they did it or not, I don't know.
So I think two important things about this project before I recommend somebody to watch it. If you grew up in a band or you were, you know, around the music industry, it is an absolutely 5-star must watch. However, if you're just a music fan, I take it down to 3.5, maybe 4 stars, because there's so much important context that's not explained at all. Like, because I recorded 4 full-length albums and wrote over 50 songs when I was in a band as a young man, and I have tons of friends that continue to be in that industry, I could sit in the room and pause it and tell everybody what was happening. And I was wondering, like, what would it be like if you were just, and a lawyer and a school teacher that sat down to watch this because you love the Beatles music? Could you get as much enjoyment out of it? Because contextually, there was so many things that weren't explained about the recording process.
Yeah, I think as far as technicalities, I think an average fan would be bored for a lot of this.
Yeah.
But I think, the average intelligent person who's ever been involved in a group project of any type can see the dynamics that you see in every, you know, a school project, the one where the teacher puts you together with 6 other people and you got to sit in a circle and come up with an outline.
Yeah.
Your objective, who's going to take what part and do what, how it's all going to come together, who's going to gather it all and make it into something you could turn in. It's the same concept.
There. Sure.
I think a person who isn't one of those people who's like, I got bored in 10 minutes and quit, will find it enjoyable. There's a certain bunch of people that I just are not going to care, and they're just not going to care. Yeah. You'll never convince them to.
Yeah. So talking about things they didn't give context to, when you watch this, they're goofing off so much. Like, they play their songs in funny ways where they'll sing Get Back and they'll do it like with an Irish accent the whole way through, or they'll do it in Paul and John are not opening their mouth. They're doing it with their teeth clenched the entire time. So they're goofing off a lot. And I think what contextually was missing that they never explained is, okay, when you're recording an album, you've got to dial in every instrument and you've got to dial in the sound of that room. So the guys that are over there running the board, you know, they might have gone into the room and say, we need to just get George's guitar sound down. So you guys just need to play. So they're just playing the song over and over again. And it does two things. When you play a song and you deconstruct it and you fuck around with it, it actually makes you more familiar with it because it starts to become second nature. But also you get bored with doing it over and over again, and you lose your focus and you lose your intensity on hitting, you know, every accent, you know, every moment of the song, like it's like your life depends on it. But at the same time, that guy in the engineering studio, especially with the equipment that they were using in 1969, he needs to have 45 minutes of George Harrison playing that solo to understand what that perfect sonic sound is. So my mother-in-law was like, man, they really, really goof off a lot. And I was like, oh, I should probably pause it and explain to them that while they're doing this, they're literally spending 45 minutes to get Ringo's snare to sound perfect for the room that they're in. And I don't think the people kind of would get that because it just looks like they're a bunch of fucking goofballs.
Yeah. I mean, from the experience I've had, not recording anything, I, of course, play or write, but with the bands that we work with and things, being in the studio, what you also don't want to have is somebody goes in and you record a few run-throughs of a track and their part. And then you days later, when you're listening back for mixing and checking, to not have gotten it. And that person's not there.
Yeah.
That wouldn't happen with them per se. With the Beatles, they had obviously unlimited time and whatever, but it's a standard thing for the recording people. Hey, you want to run through that? I'm hearing blah blah blah, you know, the engineer will, and then we'll say, but you want to give it one more take, you know, like they're there to get it right. It's on them too.
I heard a gunk. Explain to me what this gunk was.
So yeah, I mean, also I think I took from it that some of that was also, hey, we're in a high stress.
Yes.
Even though we're goofing off, we're in high show. This is a little bit of creative palate cleansing too. They don't have those songs worked out. Paul's feeling the pressure, obviously, of writing 14 songs, which isn't some sort of number that someone came up that they had to do.
Where did that number come from?
I think Paul made it up because he seems to want to put a lot of, you know, obstacles and goals out that he will then become a dick about, apparently, in this. So I think they were feeling stress, and I felt like running through and going back and looking at those old songs from when they were teenagers was a, hey, we can pull something here that we liked, but we never did. But also, won't it be cool to run through this thing that we know and relieve some of this pressure? And, you know, it happens when you're designing or creating whatever. Sometimes you've got to just like go out for a little bit out of your head.
For sure.
And I think those guys, plus I think I could tell, which is something I don't think that I thought, they love playing with each other.
Yes. And they love playing off of each other. Like the way that they would kind of, you know, see a part through the other person. And, you know, I have to say, one of my main things that I took away from this was I've underestimated just how talented Paul McCartney is. Because Beth asked me, she goes, so which one of those guys do you think is the most talented? And so whenever I get asked to do something like that, I have to go through process of elimination. I have to do my work out loud. I said, okay, Ringo is obviously in fourth place. And that's not saying that he's not like good at his job, but the other three guys are just on a whole other level. I said, Harrison is really phenomenal at playing guitar. But the problem with Harrison is he's one of those people that's so bright and so creative that there's a kink in the funnel, right? And there's so much in his head that he can only get 5% of it out because the thoughts are like the 405 at rush hour. All these little thoughts are trying to get off at the same exit, and they're just fighting, and they can't get out, so he can't process what he's doing.
And then there's a line of the Hare Krishnas at the exit, and he can't get past them to get off the road.
Who are those guys? Oh, the George's friends. And then Lennon is for sure the genius of the group. But I think also watching this, you realize he has such a level of creativity that it manifests into some sort of, you know, attention deficit disorder, that he also has a hard time processing his brilliance. And so it comes out in all these ways, and some of them are misfires. But as far as like raw, talented, but also being creatively diverse, where you can write the song, but also manage the suits and manage the timeline, Paul McCartney was the real deal in all aspects. Like, I had no idea that he was such a boss.
I agree with you 100% on all of those assessments. I think that because of what you just said about all of them is why this project is so interesting.
Yeah.
To be able to see that. We've only ever heard Lennon McCartney, greatest songwriting team ever in the world. The Beatles, you know, and you just hear the Beatles becomes this thing that is so colossal. But, you know, growing up, my first like real like attention to the Beatles came, my brother had the White Album.
Yeah.
And I would go and sit in his room with the green shag carpet, the purple walls, and the dope smoke and listen to the White Album. So I was off to a great start there. But nobody in the family really listened to the earlier stuff, the Please Please Me, Love Me Do, any of that kind of stuff.
That stuff doesn't resonate with me.
I like it, but it isn't what I like about the Beatles.
Exactly.
Because it wasn't my first connection. Then my next connection is John Lennon is shot. Double Fantasy comes out. We're inundated with this tragedy that I think then at my age, you know, like 10, then I was just getting to the point of going, okay, somebody, I see all these people out here in the streets holding these candles and this some man, crazy man shot this person down who was a musician, and it was on the radio all the time. It was, you know, everywhere. And so I latched on to John as like my thing. And I've always been the biggest John fan, while I appreciate everyone else. But I think that we see that, like, I'm kind of getting off track, but what I'm trying to get at is that what we're seeing there is everyone is going in a lane.
Yes.
And they say it. George tries to tell Paul in that first episode how many times, I don't think I'm needed on this song.
He keeps going, like, what about Eric Clapton? I'm like, what the fuck is the matter with you?
It's like he was booking his replacement in the band. I think I'm going to cut out, guys. I'm going to go home. I've already told you, Eric's great. He can do exactly what you're asking for. Maybe give him a ring. You know, he's trying to tell him that, and Paul's trying to be very, let's keep the gang together, I feel.
Yeah.
Because I don't think Paul could see past the Beatles. I don't think he could see a future where there wasn't a Beatles, where he wasn't doing what he was doing. Because he was getting everything he wanted out of it. He was the boss, even though he thinks John's the boss. He was the boss. He was, at this point now, planning these large events. You know, this was supposed to be lead up to a live concert where they played an album full from start to finish of these 14 songs. And he, I feel like, was the force behind all of that. So I feel like he was just trying to keep everything together. But we can totally see that everyone is, from just the little lines they say and the content of the songs and the vibe that they were giving off in everything, that they were, this band was not sustainable anymore.
No. And I mean, in many ways, think about it. When they start in 1960, they were young. They had everything to conquer. And in that opening documentary where, you know, Peter Jackson, as quickly as possible, shows you what these four young men with their manager and producer, what they were able to do in the most incredibly tight window, 10 years. And it also showed that trajectory of, you're the newest thing, you're the best thing, everybody loves you until everybody learns to hate you. And they had hit a moment where that the next product cycle is resentment. I've felt it in every project that I've done. When your band's a new band, you're the popular band. And you say this, you do that, and next thing you know, you're a villain. The same thing happened in the poster world. Same thing happened in the podcast world. Same thing will happen to me in the YouTube world. It is a product cycle. You're new, you're discoverable, you are lovable until you're hateable. And so they stop playing live. They kind of go into this shell, and they're going through so many different emotions, and you can kind of see that, you know, this was their college years or their lost years, and now they're kind of found. Like, they were like four buds figuring this out together, and like you said, each one of them has discovered a lane, and all of these lanes are going in so many different directions. And then, of course, you add in life, you know, Yoko, Linda, kids, you know, like, life will push you in different directions. They were no longer living in hotels and tour buses and you know, like, basically on a slumber party that wouldn't end for 6 months at a time.
Yeah, and Paul says, you know, they start talking about Mr. Epstein, you know, Brian Epstein, their manager, the one who found them and got them going. You know, they told us to wear the suits, we wore the suits. They told us to be on the car at this time. They told us to be on the stage at this time. And he was like, we really don't know how to do this without someone being in charge. Yeah. And I think he felt like he needed to be in charge there. And but at the same time, they weren't the people they were under Mr. Epstein. They were also living in arguably the most tumultuous decade in America's history, you know, in modern times.
Yeah.
So they were going through personal changes, but also like out there in a crazy ass world going through the changes of the time also. And yeah, so they're, I don't know what at this time, are they like 28, 29-ish, maybe something like that? Yeah, you're probably not the same person you were.
No, God, no. Especially being a kid in Liverpool in 1960 and being John Lennon and Paul McCartney in London in 1969, you have traveled the world 10 times over. You have had every bizarre experience that you could imagine. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about this, because at the end of the day, this documentary is about discovering the creative process. And I think what it shows you is showing four of the absolute best people at what they do go through the creative process. I think it humanizes it and it makes it easy for everybody to understand. And part of the creative process is dealing with outside forces. So in the world of like freelance or most people that do something creative, it's the client, right? Like, it's, you are doing a task for a client because they're giving you money, and that's sort of the check you got to cash to get your creativity done. But with the Beatles, their outside force are these suits. There's the guy who's pushing them and pushing them and pushing them because he wants to make a movie. He doesn't give a fuck about their inner dynamics. He wants a Beatles movie on his resume. He's done one with the Stones. If he can do one with the Beatles, now he's just checked off and he's, you know, rock and roll filmmaking royalty. And there's just so many different people that are coming and going. And I'm so glad they showed the outside forces, because literally as the band is sitting in a circle, the sharks are just swimming around them at all times.
Yeah, that guy, I guess that's the director. He is just treating them as a means to an end.
Yeah.
At this point,
they're monkeys.
They're a product. Yeah. They're not the creatives. They're not the Beatles anymore. Even they are these four guys he's got to convince to do something that he wants them to do. But they know a couple of them know that the weight of this is like in their history.
Yes.
It's on their resume. It may be the last thing anybody sees, I think, is what some of them are feeling. You know, the pressure of that, especially Paul.
Yeah.
At that time.
I just found it like fascinating how it showed that even when they're writing a record, and some of this was by their own decision, but even when they're writing a record, you just can't shake off the industry, you know? And I know that why can I not think of his name off the top of my head? Their producer, the older, like attractive guy with the silver hair.
George Martin.
George Martin. Thank you. George Martin just leaves them be. And when he stepped in, you could tell that he was a really good producer, because there's a couple of parts where he's in there like telling them, like, you know, what about this part? Or, you know, he's like humming around like ba 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 ba, and they're like kind of following along. But he just kind of let them be. It was the filmmaking crew and a couple of the business people that kind of came in there that just really treated them like they were an item, you know, like they weren't people, like they were just a commodity or a product. And I don't think that many people really have ever seen what that part of this eye of the hurricane looks like, you know? And I found that to be one of the most fascinating parts. Like, there was the older bald guy that came in that was like a business guy, and he's like chumming it up with everybody. And you could see that Paul took the weight of a lot of that. And you could see the people would just talk Ringo's ear off, and he would just be like, yeah, yeah. Just have nothing to say and just kind of hang with everybody. I did like the moment he goes, I just farted. I thought I would tell you instead of just sitting here. But I love that Paul would negotiate with all the suits and then go back over to his stool and go back to working on Get Back or whatever song they were working on. But also what I found very interesting is when the guy started saying, the director started saying, well, what about the stage? What do you want the stage to be? And immediately he stopped him and goes, you go talk to them, pointing over at John and Yoko. They're the artist. So they clearly had definable roles of where I handled the business, he handles the vision. And I found that to be really interesting because you could tell that they knew kind of where each other's territory began and end on what they were responsible for.
Oh, yeah. He was showing it to him, and Paul was like interested, but he was like, go ask John what he thinks about it.
Yeah, he's the artist.
Which I did appreciate because he could have just run roughshod over the whole thing, but he did know that John was going to have an opinion, and yep. He is the artist. He's more of the artist. I'm more of the technician. You know, watching this, I discovered that Paul, to me, was kind of like, if anybody knows anything about Fleetwood Mac, there's a bunch of weirdos in that band.
Yeah, you better believe it.
Total. And everybody's got their own thing and their own interpersonal relationships and talk about the pressures in and out or whatever. But Lindsey Buckingham is the fucking technician in that band. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He pisses every one of them off. There's a documentary about the making of one of their latter 2000s albums. And he is just nonstop from beginning to end, controlling the whole thing, pissing everyone off and not accepting the pushback very well, but he's also responsible for the reason that those albums sound the way they do and for being able to go, I can take this crazy shit that Stevie Nicks is saying and I can make everyone like it.
Yeah.
Like what it turn it into a product that is memorable, that people will remember, that sounds good, and pull all these other people's talents together. And I kind of just, this is an odd observation, but it struck me from watching the other documentary that it was very much the same thing. And you know, two very fucking successful bands. And because they have somebody like that in them, if you get a bunch of people with all Ringos or all Georges or all Johns or the three of them without that one, they're not the same band.
No, I mean, it really does show that, you know, they say that opposites attract in relationships. And I don't know how true that is as far as like, you know, my husband hates sports, but I love them. Like, I don't know how that, it's more of opposites attract, like this person is insecure and this person's overconfident. So one borrows from the other. I think that's kind of how opposites attract. And in many ways, each one of these guys could give the other ones something that they couldn't give, you know, or that they weren't capable of giving. I think also too, there's a misconception, and you know, you and I have listened to thousands of hours of Howard Stern, and he's obsessed with songwriting to the point where it's almost unbearable to listen to him interview musicians, because Howard has this poetic idea of how songs are written. And as somebody who's written songs, granted, honestly, I never wrote a hit song, so I'm not saying I'm fucking Paul McCartney, but the process is pretty similar. Because if you listen to all these interviews on Stern, what everybody's kind of trying to tell Stern, and he just can't pick up on, is songwriting isn't as glamorous as you think it is. You don't have a little journal in your back pocket, and you write a poem, and then you sit down to the piano, and you write a song to that. You come up with a riff, and you go, then he had some toast instead. You know what I mean? Like you literally hear the riff, you mumble your way through it, like John said, cauliflower. Everything's cauliflower until it's something else. You like mumble your way through it, and then it starts to take shape. So like Get Back. Technically, you could say Paul McCartney wrote that in like 2 minutes because he's sitting there with his bass and he just came up with that bass line and he just starts mumbling. And I'm not even, I mean, he wasn't even as close as I am right now. But to refine that and to get it perfect and to say to George, like, no, don't come in on the end, come in off the downbeat. So when you re-listen to that song, those big crashes that bum 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 bam bum 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 bam, there's actually a beat in there that they're skipping, and that accent is on the downbeat instead of the upbeat. And it's like the refining of it is it would bore the fucking piss out of you, and it did.
It will. But I also sat there and I was like, okay, we're hearing something that we've already heard, the final product.
Yes.
And then this didn't exist before this moment. And that was what was one of the most fascinating things for me, was like, we're watching a spark happen.
Yep.
And then all of the little suggestions and directions and offshoots that they were throwing in there. And I was like, oh, no, don't do that. They didn't do it. But I'm like already going, don't do that. That's bad.
Yeah.
Because I've heard what ended up being the masterpiece of it. And I was just like also noting, like, a lot of these ideas that they're putting here are really bad. Like, I'm glad they weeded these out, but it took all of them to do it. It took John being able to say, no, you know, not, that's not, no, let's do this. Or, but I feel like this is how, you know. So it wasn't so totalitarian in that I'm Paul McCartney and I sit here and doodle this up and you do this part and you do that part. Like, Ringo stands up at one point there and starts doing the tap, the beats and and the things to it, and is further propulsing ahead what Paul is doing as he's doing it. But I was just so amazed that we were watching, like, now I'm like, what else would I want to see this happen with? Like, we're seeing the birth of it from the inside out, not someone in an interview with Howard Stern saying, oh, well, you know, I sat down and there was just a little riff I had, and then George and Ringo were there, and we talked. You know, you're seeing it, and you're watching George like look like he's not paying any fucking attention, but he is. And then it picks up the guitar. At every point when someone sees or feels something, they start to just step right in and contribute. Yeah. And what I also got from that was, as contentious as their relationship has always been played out to be for the public eye, these guys love each other. They respect each other. They understand each other's part in the group, and it isn't as, I'm sure that behind the doors fights and things were like everyone in a family relationship, you know, it can get really intense or whatever, but ultimately, like, they all came together for the music. I mean, it sounds really hokey to say that, but any one of them could have walked out of this session and never come back based on any number of factors, being the suits, the timing, the pressure, the outside influences or whatever, but they didn't. And that they were, and times quick to defend each other too. There's the part where they have the meeting after George has said, see you at the clubs, guys. I think I'm done. Yeah. I'm leaving the band. And they have the meeting. They come back and John and Yoko are late. And so Paul is talking to the other people who were not there, telling them what happened. And he was saying, well, you know, John didn't say it. Yoko spoke for John, you know, and that, I think the other people got something in their mind about meaning that Yoko took over and was talking, but John or Paul was quick to defend and say, you know, about her being there. Well, they want to be around each other. They want to be near each other. And he says you cannot fault them for that.
Right. There was a moment when, in that same conversation, Paul goes, and then there were two, and it's him and Ringo. And I looked over at my family and I go, and they're the only two that are alive. Like, it was a very eerie thing because, you know, the other two aren't there. Going back to songwriting for a minute, something else that I like wanted to pause and explain to the family is, like, you know, when those guys were just riffing around, Ringo's just like, just giving them a beat, like scratch drums, you know? And I was explaining to him, I'm like, you know, like, right now it's not Ringo's job to figure out fills or all the stuff. Like, they just need essentially like a metronome to jam to, you know? And in that creative process, how they like passed it back and forth and redefined the lyrics and figured out the actual structure, like, it really showed the teamwork that is a band, and how if you're with really good players, everybody gets their hands on that and it starts to form and shift. And like you said, you know, the context of this film is so important. Nobody had ever made a documentary like this. These songs did not exist yet. You're watching so much happen for the first time. So as they're songwriting, they're also reminding themselves, whatever you do, don't look into the camera because the cameras aren't supposed to be here. It's a documentary. And they're in that songwriting process, and they would get so close to playing the song right. You're like, and then they would go back the other way. And I think for anybody here that's ever had like Photoshop crash on you, and you go, fuck, I haven't saved in an hour. The second time you build that file that crashed on you, it's so much easier because it was that last hour of problem solving that told you how it was supposed to be done. And so in this process, we're seeing, do I move the logo over to the left? What if it's pink? Does it need a stroke on it? Is this font look better? What if I italicize this word? What if I take the and make it tiny in the top right? You know, when it's all done, you know how it's supposed to be. But any single one of us, when we make anything, you move pieces and parts around, but you have the ability to do it by yourself in silence. You don't have to say to somebody else, could you move the word the over there? And you, could you make the photo black and white? Could you, you know, like, it's a team sport, music. And some people thrive off of that and some people hate it. But I felt like the way that they showed writing songs and recording an album, it showed that it's grueling. It's not pretty. It's not always fun. It's frustrating. It will push you to the end of your limits. And I just feel like when somebody like Howard Stern is trying to interview, like he wants this poetic version of Rod Stewart just sits down and grabs a guitar and writes Maggie May because he was fucking an older chick and she broke his heart. It's just like many songs mean nothing. Many songs literally are only the words that rhyme to the riff.
Right. One instance in this, you know, you hear a familiar tune coming out of John, and it's a song he really wants to put on here. He brings it up many times, The Road to Marrakesh. That's Jealous Guy.
Yeah.
It becomes Jealous Guy later. Was The Road to Marrakesh probably going to be a great song? No.
Yeah.
What he was doodling around there with. But as it was going, I was in my head and like under my breath singing Jealous Guy, which is, you know,
an amazing song.
Amazing, perfect song. And to think that that had to, you know, he had to shelf that. It didn't go. And then it comes out later on the solo work. It's just another example of the directions they were going in. I don't think if the four of them have even put their and maybe in that 150 hours of audio, there is a great version of that song. Who knows?
Yeah.
But obviously not. It didn't make the cut. No. It didn't appear on anything else. No. And we haven't seen it, to my knowledge, on anything. I'm not a Beatles completist by any means. I might have to start to be after watching this documentary, which is, I think, another amazing thing about it. But yeah, so the spark of a Howard Stern interview, maybe that Paul says, if they're talking about Jealous Guy, maybe he brings that up or something, and that's some crazy great story. But Howard also gets pissed if someone says they wrote a song in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Then he thinks they didn't put enough into it.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? Some songs just are there.
But even when you write it in 5 minutes, it takes 5 days to refine it and to perfect it and get it going. And, you know, I just get frustrated sometimes because what does a song mean? What does a song mean? It's like, those are the words that rhymed with the riff. And I mean, I think sometimes, and I know this a lot, every line in a song can be like a different thought or a different piece. And then when it's over with, and I know this from my own writing and lots of my peers, when the song's finally done, you kind of look at it and go, I guess you could say it's about this. You know what I mean? There are people that sit down and like, literally like, you know, there's the famous story of Neil Young being so disgusted at what happened in Ohio. He takes a guitar, he goes out in the woods, and he comes back in like 5 minutes and he's wrote, you know, a masterful song about a subject. So that does happen. But I'm just telling you that a lot of songs are the way they are because those are the words and riffs that kind of worked around that moment. So when you look at, you know, an Eddie Vedder song where it just looks like a bunch of gibberish, newsflash, it's a bunch of gibberish. You know, it's just the way that it works sometimes.
I think he even said that in his Howard Stern interview from this year or last year, which was brilliant, where he was really broke down and went through songs with Howard. And Howard was loving it. And some things he was just like, those are just the words that sounded good.
Yeah.
And Howard's just like, well, it doesn't mean anything. And he's like, it means something to somebody, but it's whatever it means.
Hey friends, I hope you enjoyed part one of today's episode with my good friend Connie Collinsworth. You can find more out about Connie over at La Honda Records, which is the record label that she owns that puts out some fantastic, I don't want to say country music because I know that will sort of rub some of you the wrong way, but it's music from the country, like straight up roots rock, the things that birthed rock and roll. It's like that sound that comes from authentic people telling real stories, not this like, you know, I just got a new pickup truck and I'm drinking tequila and everything's great party pop country. It's like the old stuff, but it's brand new, and you can find it over at La Honda Records. If you want to find more conversations between Connie and I, as well as the second part of today's episode, which is 45 more minutes of conversation, deep diving into the Beatles Get Back documentary, which is just a masterwork on what it means to be creative and the creative process and working with others. I don't care if you don't like the band. I don't care if you've never been in a band. It doesn't matter. Like, this is such an unbelievable look into what it means to be creative and to work with others. Two things that all of us take a lot of pride in. Two things that aren't easy ever. And we're all blessed to have found a way to get it out of us. If you'd like to hear part two of today's episode and catch our back catalog of so many more, head over to AID.network where you can become a proud member of the Circle of Trust to get episodes early, to get bonus content, and to hear many episodes 100% commercial free. Let's get started with part two. It begins at AID.network. You bring up a great point, Connie, because it's John and Paul's job to find the words that sound good and make sense. But it's you driving your car, walking your dog, going to bed, making love, fighting, hanging out at the state fair. It's you listening to this song, creating your own music video, giving its own context is when the song has true meaning. And that's why if you write songs and you use words like you and me and us, people at home can say, that's me. I'm me in this song. And you is my wife in this song. And us is me and my kids in this song. Like, that's why when you use those sort of generic words, people can interpret it into their own world versus being like, no, in order to like this song, you got to be Allison that Elvis Costello was writing about. You have to be Allison to enjoy this song. I mean, and those songs have their place too, you know, when you use a proper name. But the songwriting process is like anything in entertainment. You can't be selfish. To be a good entertainer, you have to have empathy for your customer, empathy for your audience, and you have to make things that mean something to somebody else. And I think a lot of that gets lost because people want to think of it as being this magical experience. And this movie really showed what an ugly, complex, it's like building a fucking home. It's just at the end of it, you get something that's looked at as more genius because not everybody can write fucking Hey Jude.
Yeah, those songs... No greater example for me of the words don't make any sense when you look at them, but when I hear them, I create my own thing is Kurt Cobain.
100%. I guarantee you he was one of these kind of songwriters.
You look and it's just he crafted the words that somehow sounded the best, looked the best, had the most impact together, and then the way he sang them and the way the music went with gives you a feeling. And then it's however you apply that feeling in your life. For me, I'm going to bet that a song that maybe a lot of people didn't pay attention to, the two of us, you know, from this documentary, you know, that we're on our way home.
Love that song.
That thing is going to be in weddings now for people who never listened to this album. That's going to be just a crazy, like, I don't know, like a maybe funerals even for people. That song is now going to have, because it's been repetitive, it's been over and over, and you see the relationship. It's almost like the two of us, like John and Paul, even in the context of what they're doing there. But then people are going to take that and those words and that feeling and apply it to their life. And I could see it being like such a sentimental, feel good song for people.
Have you ever heard the Amy Mann cover of that?
No. I love her.
I'm a huge Amy Mann fan.
Me too. How did we not know this about each other? Even going back till two.